Welcome back to Spanning the State. I'm Kristen Bry.
I'm Brian Noonan. And Kristen, you were a teenage girl at one point.
I was.
But thankfully, there probably wasn't a lot of social media back then, was there?
No, I think the soonest I had anything was MySpace. And I think I was like 18 or 19 I finally got that.
See, that's you're already starting to, you know, get your adult mind.
And then you had to be on a computer to do it.
Yeah.
Like there wasn't MySpace on your phone.
Thank goodness. Well, since the dawn of social media, there have been countless articles and everybody's got an opinion on teens and social media, how they're affected by it, how they use it, and specifically its effect on girls. Well, the only thing that seemed to be missing from all of these conversations was input from actual teenage girls. So Dr. Kate Phelps, she said, I don't want to deal with this anymore. She wanted to remedy that. In her new book, Digital Girlhood, Dr. Phelps actually spoke to adolescent girls about social media. She is a University of Wisconsin-Madison Women and Gender Studies researcher, and she joins us now to share what she found. Dr. Phelps, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
So you've said in the past that you thought the way society talks about young girls and social media is too simplistic. What did you mean by that, and how did you come to that conclusion?
Well, I think certainly social media is something that is still very infantile in our understandings of it and its impacts. And I was struck by, in particular, a lot of attention that was being paid to how it was impacting girls, and particularly adolescent girls that are in this sort of tween category. Because I think it's important to note that a 13-year-old is not a 17-year-old. Those ages, those experiences are really very different. But a lot of the response to seeing adolescent girls online has been around a lot of fear around things like body image, around risk taking or reputation, or how girls are posting and maybe being reckless in how they're posting. And I thought that that alarmist response was really not engaging a very nuanced or even full picture of how this group of people, how girls are using social media, how they're participating on it, and more to the point, what they think and feel about it. So I really wanted to set out to hear from those girls themselves, because they are among the first generations to really grow up with having been involved and visible on social media in a way that my generation and other generations did not experience that. Very, very similar to what you said, Kristen, was my experience was when it started with MySpace,
mm-hmm.
right? And Facebook was only available for college students when it first started in 2004. And the original idea of Facebook was to rank college girls on their attractiveness.
I know.
So it was not the behemoth that it has come to be. But I think it's really important to recognize that marginalized groups and girls have been online and a part of these spaces from the very beginning, and they have a lot to say about it. Yeah.
So when we talk, like you said, and I think that is an important distinction. I think about that all the time as your age now. Like once you're in your 30s, you're like, I don't know, are you 33 or 39? Like we're all mm-hmm. the same. But 13 and 17.
Yeah.
Very different. And so why was it important for you to focus on the younger side of the like 10 to 13 middle school age girls versus the impacts of, you know, sophomore, junior, senior girls in high school?
Sure. Thank you. That's a great question. A lot of the research that we do have is focusing on if they are talking to people that are under the age of 18, if they are talking to minors in terms of research, do seem to be focused more on that upper teen age category. And that's really important. I mean, certainly we need information from that demographic as well. But what struck me was we really don't have much data on people under the age of 13, and yet they are very visible. They mm-hmm. are prolific on social media. But under the Children's Online Privacy and Protection Act, under COPPA, they are 13 and under are protected, and they're often not included in the survey data. Some of that is starting to shift a little bit because there's recognition that even though you're not supposed to be on social media until you are 13 years of age, people are finding ways around that.
Right.
I mean, young girls are very, very much a presence online, and often have been since they were quite young children. And some of that is through parental facilitation, through how we're posting images of children online. There's a visible presence and a part of life that is felt from very early on, because I think it's important to remember that most people at this point are participating on social media in some way, shape, or form. It is very much a part, a reflection of our social lives and how we are engaging with it. And so I think we're really laying that bare for our young people, that it's a big part of how we communicate, and girls are active in that. They participate in that, but we don't have a whole lot of information about what they have to say about it, what they say the impacts are, what they like about it, what they don't, and what their experiences have been. Which the overall takeaway, the overall takeaway that I found is that maybe there's less cause for concern in that girls have a pretty keen sense of how to navigate these spaces.
See, because that would go against, my daughter is older, so she's, she's on her own as far as social media goes. But a lot of us think that when the younger the kids, they're just posting whatever they want. They're not putting that much thought into the deeper ramifications. So your findings, that's not accurate then, right?
I am finding that that's not accurate. I think it's a balance, Brian, of how girls are engaging with social media participation. Some of it really is mundane, and they're posting images of themselves, of something they ate, of little brothers, of family members. It's this sort of normalized function in their lives where there might not be a tremendous amount of thought put into everything that they post. But an important part of that as well is that they are being really strategic about what they make public and what they keep private. And for the most part, the girls that I spoke with, and I talked to 26 tween girls between the ages of 10 and 13, and I really did hear a lot of shared themes and sort of shared narrative around, I choose to make this public. Let's say, for example, this was back when TikTok was Musical.ly. This was before Musical.ly kind of was merged into TikTok. And they would post publicly because that was really the energy and the ethos of the platform, was to have fun and be silly and sing and dance and make themselves visible on that platform. Or YouTube, for example. I talked to girls about how they had interest in things like dance or video games. There was a girl that I spoke to who would play video games and offer her commentary while she was playing them on her YouTube channel, which is a very male-dominated space. So I thought that was super interesting that that's something she had found her way to when she was really young. But they are savvy in the sense that they're thinking about, this is something I'm choosing to make public, that I'm sharing with a wider audience. But by far, far and away, girls are participating on social media with people that they know in physical space, with close circles of friends on Snapchat, in sharing images, in putting TikToks together. They really are very cognizant about who they follow and who follows them. And they've learned that through conversations with parents, with caretakers, with stakeholders. And they really do, it makes me, this is some of the nuanced element, because I have a son and a daughter, both of whom are not on social media yet. They are young. But there's this feeling that the girls shared with me that they've been conditioned to be afraid of online space, and this idea of who may be watching them, which I think says more about how we situate girls and women in media than it does about what girls themselves are posting online, right? This idea Yep. that there's danger awaiting them in online space. I think we need to have a very different conversation about why that would be dangerous for them, while also at the same time absolutely having open dialogue and conversations with caretakers and adult stakeholders in girls' lives, because they are digitally literate in a lot of ways because they've grown up with it differently, but they still need guidance.
Well, Doctor, unfortunately, we got to get to the news. Dr. Kate Phelps is our guest. The book is Digital Girlhood. Dr. Phelps is a UW Madison Women and Gender Studies researcher. This is fascinating. Everybody with a younger daughter should read it. And now that you have a son, Dr. Phelps, hopefully down the line you get one for the boys too, because I know they're having trouble as well, or concerns right. as well. So thanks very much. We will talk to you again, I'm sure. Let's do this. Then there's more. It's Spanning the State.
I'll have to get that book. I think I got a little time before I'm worried about Frankie and the social medias of it all.
Yeah.
But
I am so glad that Molly was a little later in all of this and didn't have to.
I just feel like I saw a take recently. Have you ever seen the train takes where the guy interviews people on the train? He goes, "What's your hot take?" And someone was like, "We all need Sundays, no internet."
I like that.
Just shut it down. No internet's for anyone on Sundays because everyone needs a break.
Well, we will take a break because ABC News and local headlines are next. Welcome back to Spanning the State. I'm Brian Noonan.
And I'm Kristen Bry. And prior to the Trump administration, there was an understood precedent that the federal government can ask local law enforcement for help on immigration, but it is up to them to decide how much to cooperate. Now, with the Trump administration ramping up U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, operations, and Republican state lawmakers pushing for more collaboration, sheriffs could play a key role in how immigration is enforced here in Wisconsin. So how do Wisconsin sheriffs feel about it? Well, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and USA Today Network Wisconsin surveyed all 72 Wow. sheriffs in Wisconsin about their views and policies on immigration enforcement. So the two lead reporters on that were Gina Castro, who's a public investigator reporter, and Eva Wen, who is a data reporter. And they join us now in the studio. Thanks for joining us, ladies.
Thank you for having us.
So I guess before we get into what the response was from the sheriffs, what is the help that ICE would want from a sheriff's office?
There are a few ways that sheriffs can help ICE. One of them is through a program called 287G, where they can, certain staff of the sheriff's department can be deputized as ICE officers after certain trainings and perform certain functions. And some other ways sheriffs can collaborate with ICE include, you know, holding immigrants after, you know, their scheduled release date in their jail, or they can, you know, contract with ICE to hold immigrant detainees, which is different from, you know, their jail detainees in their jails.
Got it.
So there, as we mentioned, there's 72 sheriffs in Wisconsin. How hard was it to get them to cooperate, and how many of them actually did respond to your request for comment?
It was quite a feat. We had, you know, the Journal Sentinel working on it, the Green Bay Press Gazette, and Appleton Press Post Crescent, and the we had an intern from Northwestern University. So it's about 11 of us. We divided all of these 72 counties, and then we did three waves of reaching out to them, more than three waves probably. We had them answer our round one questions. We tried calling, emailing them to answer those questions. Then we sent them a survey and to get them to answer those questions. Then we kept calling and emailing beyond that if they weren't responding. And we got about 56 in total to either send us their policy or respond to some of our round one questions or the survey that we sent. and then the rest didn't respond or just fully declined.
Just fully declined? Did they give a reason?
There were some mixed bags.
Yeah, some of them kept pushing back a date to respond, you know, saying like their sheriff isn't available. Some of them just, you know, said we don't have an immigration policy and we're not required to answer your questions.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Which is true, right? They're not required to have an immigration policy and they, I mean, it's mostly for the transparency of if they would want to be more upfront with their feelings on it. It's just up to their discretion. It's not like an open records request or anything like that.
Well, the policy part would be an open record request.
Okay.
So a lot of them just at least did that part.
Okay.
For the ones who didn't have a policy. But some people who didn't have a policy did answer at least a few questions.
Okay. So of the 56 who did respond or you got some kind of information from, was there any kind of overwhelming sentiment that everyone shared or was everything kind of different?
Yeah, so overall, a lot of sheriffs emphasize that this is a federal responsibility and sheriffs are not able to make immigration arrests, which is, you know, they're legally not allowed to do that. But some sheriffs are saying also, you know, their jails are so small that they cannot hold immigrants for sheriffs for a longer time, hold immigrants for ICE for a longer time, or, you know, some of them also said, you know, I would be glad to collaborate with ICE. We're like good federal partners and stuff. So it really varied quite a bit.
Okay.
Did you find any specific or interesting trends as far as parts of the state or how populous a county was as far as how the sheriffs responded?
A little bit. We had 9 counties that told us they didn't have a policy. And that included like Walworth and Calumet. And those counties have like under 200,000 in the population. So I guess it kind of made sense why it wasn't, you know, completely on their radar.
Well, and that's kind of my question. So in the article you referenced that it's estimated that there's around 70,000 living undocumented immigrants in Wisconsin. I don't know how you get to that number, but people have tried to do the math. And so across the state of almost 6 million people, that's not a lot. But I would have to assume more are in the southeast region, largely just because that is the most populous region of the state, maybe some in Madison. So that leaves a lot of the counties that probably don't, this isn't an issue at all. And so I wondered how much that kind of overlapped with the either further north or very small populous counties, like if there was just kind of a shrugging of shoulders of this isn't going to really pertain to us.
Mm-hmm.
Did that come up at all?
Yeah, it definitely came up. Yeah. But some of the Wisconsin is such a large agricultural state that a lot of undocumented immigrants are the actual farm workers in our state. So there are some sheriffs from like more rural Wisconsin that said, you know, they have heard concerns from farm owners about, you know, roundups and stuff if they will lose their workers.
Got it.
Yeah. Now, last week, the assembly passed this bill that probably isn't going to go anywhere, but it would compel sheriffs to cooperate with ICE. The governor said if it makes it to his desk, he's not going to sign it anyway. So what happens from there? Is it going to remain each county's individual policy? So we're basically not going to have any change?
That's what would happen if the governor does not sign the bill into law. So the sheriffs will still have, you know, legally their discretion to decide whether or not they collaborate with ICE or not. An immigration offense is actually, you know, not a criminal offense. It is a civil offense. So, you know, like when we say undocumented immigrants are criminals, that is actually not a valid statement. So the sheriffs do have the discretion to, think about this collaboration, but we are seeing more counties enter this 287G agreement where they will, you know, collaborate with ICE more and, you know, deputize some of their staff to do some enforcement actions.
We're sitting here in Milwaukee County. What's the policy here?
Yeah, here in Milwaukee, they don't ask people at traffic stops about their immigration status. They only do that in their county jail, but they don't fact check that. So they just ask for you to write that down, but they don't actually ask that or verify if it's true. And then for crime victims or witnesses of a crime who happen to be undocumented. They don't have to provide that information. They don't ask that information. So they should feel safe to report, crimes.
Okay. For the final question before I let you guys go, was there any, when for the sheriffs that actually did sit down for an interview or answer questions beyond writing down a survey, anything that stood out to you as far as their concerns or their thoughts about this?
One thing I did find surprising is back with that crime victims and crime or witnesses of crimes, we had only 16 sheriffs actually respond to our survey part, and 12 of them did say that they would not ask a crime victim their status and would not report that to ICE. But many of the, the other, total of 56, but many of their policies didn't actually answer that question. So that's still open-ended. I was kind of surprised.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, they do have a section where they say, we want to encourage crime reporting and stuff. So we will treat crime reporters equally, but that does not guarantee, they will not ask for immigration status or anything like that.
Yeah, they often had another policy added on there that any officer could still report that to ICE if they chose.
Got it. All right. Well, really interesting feat that you guys got. All 72 sheriffs in Wisconsin to get their view on this. But Gina Castro is a public investigator reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Eva Nguyen is a data reporter for Journal Sentinel. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, ladies.
Thank you.
All right, we'll come back with more after this.
Oh my goodness. It is spanning the state.
It is spanning the state. I was trying to see if we got any updates on the text leak. Is it a leak?
It was a breach because it wasn't leaked.
If you get invited into the group chat, is it a leak?
It's not a leak because, like you said, Goldberg was invited in. He was in there. He wasn't hiding. Nobody slipped him the information confidentially. He was brought in.
What I mean. That's why it's like, I don't know. What word do we even have for this?
A complete and total screw up. Security breach would be probably the best way to do it. Now, since we talked about it, the latest is that the president is coming out and saying that no, there was no classified information shared on that signal chain. He is saying that his national security advisor, Mike Walls, is great. He's praising them and the whole team. Earlier, Tulsi Gabbard and CIA head Ratcliffe were in front of the Senate. They were supposed to be there on a foreign terrorism hearing, but it turned into a hearing on this text debacle. And they all said also that there was no classified information, but there's a delineation between civilian run departments like the CIA and military classified information. So what may not be classified for the CIA is definitely classified by the military. And so that's where some hairs were being split during the hearings today.
The other thing that I was just thinking about as far as last week when we were talking about Sunshine Week and open records law and how so much information we are as citizens, as journalists, you can have a request for an open records request. Is it legal for them to be doing Signal? As far as things that need to be documented eventually, maybe redacted, maybe classified, but having conversations that disappear over Signal, is that not some kind of failing?
Everything I've been reading today and yesterday says yes, that these conversations should have been held either in the Situation Room at the White House or in one of the secure locations in one of their departments.
Yeah.
They have those yurts that they travel with that are security. So it was all supposed to be handled in there. But once again, we have the administration has reverted to blaming the Atlantic for this whole thing. It's the Atlantic's fault because they dared to listen on a conversation they were invited to join. That's odd.
All right, let's do this, and then we'll come back and hand it off to Wisconsin's Afternoon News.
I believe it's time for me to fly.
Fly, fly, like a bird. That's what Forrest Gump was on last night.
Was he?
Mm-hmm.
And did you watch the whole thing,
Jenny? I did not watch the whole thing, but I did watch some of it. Because I saw that movie when I was first a kid, and there were a lot of things I didn't understand. And now a lot more I do understand.
Now you know why Mama was getting him into school. All right. Well, that's good. It's good to know these things. All right. We got to get out of here. Wisconsin's Afternoon News is next.
See ya.